Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Deputy Editor Helen Lewis, and this week I'll be talking to George Eaton and Anoosha Kadian about Labour's plans for the railways and Tories' plans for welfare. Then Tozin Thompson, Ian Steadman and I ask whether or not we would be willing to die on Mars. And finally, slightly more cheerfully, Barbara Speed and Caroline Crampton discuss the future of podcasts, including ours. There are less than 80 days to go until the general election, and I'm joined by our political editor George Eaton and Anoosha Kadian, acting editor of The Staggers, to catch up on the latest from Westminster. George, let's start off with you first. So you interviewed Michael Duggett this week, who is Labour's transport spokesman, and he had some, I guess it was meat and drink to the left of the party, certainly words about the privatisation or the evils thereof of the railway system.
Absolutely. So Labour's position to date has been that they will establish a public sector operator to take on private companies as rail franchises come up for renewal. Duggar has significantly toughened the position by saying, we want to take some of these back into the public sector as soon as possible. We're looking at scrapping franchising altogether. There might not be a bidding process. We think it's inefficient. It's cost money in the past. And he's also said we want public control of the railways. So it's a socialist-style description of a new rail passenger body that they promised, which will have more control over things like ticket prices, because he says at the moment it's a cosy industry stitch-up and we want to do away with that.
He must be emboldened, presumably, by the success of the East Coast Main Line, which was privatised, got taken back into public hands after the failure of the operator, and has had very, very good figures on punctuality and service.
Absolutely. And I think, as he pointed out, you know, East Coast has returned $1 billion to the Treasury while it was in public hands, outperformed a lot of the other franchises. But there's a wider ideological shift that he alludes to when he says it's not like in 1997, that whole deference to markets and the private sector has gone. And so he sees himself very much as in line with Ed Miliband on that, in believing that New Labour was far too close to the private sector and far too relaxed about the market.
I think that's what I find interesting about it, because it seems to be that if you're whatever your ideology, you should probably take the plan of what works, right? What delivers most value to the taxpayer, what delivers most money to the Treasury. So the idea that the Tories are desperate to reprivatise the East Coast Main Line, even when it's proved a success, it's sort of this kind of bizarre idea that, like, I'm going to ignore actual success because it doesn't fit with my ideological preconception of what ought to be the best thing to do. Anyway, we could talk about rail all day and probably will one day, but I just want to talk to you, Anoosha, a little bit about the big theme of the week for the Tories, which has been welfare. How's that gone?
Welfare week. You probably wouldn't know it was welfare week for the Tories because it seems to have fallen a bit flat. Not only did they decide to have their welfare week in this sort of recess half-term period where nothing actually happens, which shows that it is a bit of an afterthought for them. They've also had it, as George pointed out in his column in this week's magazine, a week after they had this very opulent black and white gala ball that was rather controversial because of the expensive auction prizes that were on offer there.
So they've got a real pasting, and actually from people on the right as well, rightfully, about the idea that you go into an election where you're saying we've all got to tighten our belts, you know, the economic crisis isn't over, I know the times are tough, but, and then at the same time to have a ball where you ask people for £1,500 a ticket and you sell pheasant shoots, it's just, I know that there is a problem for Labour, and that people sort of think, well, you just come in and turn the money taps on. But they must know, surely, that everybody's bad preconception of the Tories is they're the party of the rich.
Exactly. The most toxic thing for the Tories is that they're seen as the party of the privileged, the party of the rich. But actually, I think it is a symptom of the optimism in the Conservative Party that they're happy to have those kind of events. I noticed it at Tory conference last year. There were so many champagne receptions. And in the 2 years previously, they'd absolutely had
an austerity thing, didn't they? The worst thing was the idea that you get a photo of David Cameron holding a glass of champagne in black tie while saying, no, come on, we're all in this together. But that mood seems to have gone, which is not at odds. It is at odds with the idea of what the message they're putting out on the election campaign.
It is at odds with what they're saying. They're saying we need to cut the welfare budget because the spending is still too high. But it is at odds with the way that they're feeling within the party, which is very optimistic about their chances at winning the election. And also they have this paradoxical message that the recovery is on its way. The cost of living crisis is over. Mm. Unemployment is going down. So there's this doublethink that they want people to buy into.
And George, you mentioned in your column this week that actually Labour have perked up a bit from the start of the year too. Why is that?
Mm. Well, I think they feel that the Tories have thrown quite a lot at them. They had that big press conference at the start of the year on Labour spending plans. They've had attacks from some of their business supporters, people like Stuart Rose, the former boss of M&S, who's now a Conservative peer. They were hoping that would really dent Labour in the polls and that their advantage, the Tories' lead on economic competence and on leadership through David Cameron, would start to spill over into the national polls. And it hasn't really. I mean, Labour's lead has remained. The Tories were hoping that January would be crossover month and that they'd move decisively ahead later. That hasn't happened. And so Labour are feeling reassured by that. And then, of course, last week went very well for them with the tax avoidance row. Of course, it's become more complicated since with the row over Ed Balls and receipts and Ed Miliband's deed of variation on his home.
Yeah.
But I think Labour feel if the debate is tax avoidance and the super rich, we are going to be the party benefit because that's home territory for us. The subject is not the deficit. I mean, that really has fallen off the agenda. And that is a big problem for the Tories.
Talking things that have fallen off the agenda, UKIP and the Lib Dems have both noticeably suffered in the last couple of weeks, haven't they? They're both struggling to get their messages out. Is that going to... I mean, can you see them surging back and the level of interest that we've had in them growing again?
I think it'll be very hard for UKIP to recover the momentum they had last summer when, obviously, having won the European elections, they then had the defections of Douglas Carswell and Mark Reckless. But they will remain significant players in the debate because immigration is still one of the top issues and they're rated as the best party on that and on Europe. And that's the first time that a protest party has owned issues in that way. And of course, they peaked at a level much higher than people expected. So though they're not really going up, they haven't actually fallen away too much in the polls. And the Lib Dems, I think, do seem increasingly irrelevant, though the irony is that, of course, they've a far better chance of being in government than the Greens, the Lib Dems, and obviously the SNP as well, who said we wouldn't be in a full coalition. So in some ways, their policies deserve to receive closer attention. But I think the real problem, and one that Jeremy Brown's often pointed out, is that they don't have a distinctive message anymore, that too often it is just splitting the difference. Mm. And he says we don't pass the Freshers' Fair test, that if a student came along hoping to be inspired and is told, well, join us because we're more economically responsible than Labour and we're nicer than the Tories. It doesn't exactly make your heart leap
on a banner,
with
can
joy.
You?
Yeah. So I think both the left, Tim Farron, and the right of the party, Jeremy Brown, do think the Lib Dems need to, after this election, have a serious think about what they stand for again, particularly in an era of multi-party politics, the rise of the Greens, the rise of the Nationalists. The Lib Dems do have to do more to stand out.
Well, we'll bring you an exciting analysis of all the Lib Dem policy manifesto over the course of several hours. No, we won't do that. But we will talk more about the smaller parties because I think that's something that keeps coming up again and again this election. But for the moment, I'll say thank you very much to George and Anoush. Who wants to die on Mars? Well, it turns out quite a lot of people do. There has been a shortlisting for the Mars One project this week, and we found out some of the top contenders to take a one-way trip into space. I'm joined by our science and tech blogger Ian Steadman and our new Welcome Scholar Tozin Thompson to talk about why anybody would want to leave Earth forever and never come back, really. So Tozin, first of all, tell me, what exactly is the project? Who's behind it, for a start?
It's a non-profit organisation. They're trying to send about 40 people to Mars to, you know, live there permanently. Whether it's feasible or not is, you know, anyone's guess.
They're not a proper space organisation, are they? They're a Dutch non-profit / reality TV show production company, yeah. Aren't they?
But that, I find that so fascinating, because there are various different projects we talked about before about going to Mars. So Elon Musk is very keen. He's got this saying that he says, "I want to die on Mars, just not on impact."
Yes.
Which is, I think, a reasonable ambition to have. Yeah. We talked about another project. They were talking about how they wanted to send a middle-aged couple on the basis that, you know, a Mars mission is going to take you a couple of years. And really, if you're going to be trapped on a very... I mean, you know, if you've lived in a student house, you'll know the sheer hell of other people. And imagining that travelling through space over the course of a couple of years is truly terrifying. Ian, though, even though this project... I would suggest is probably these people are not going to go to Mars.
Mm.
What's the likely time frame for somebody going to Mars?
Well, I'd say the likely time frame at or around 2030, because that is NASA's target. And as we know, they're an actual organization that has a history of landing people on things. Whether that's going to be pushed back, I mean, there is, you know, a reasonable possibility that might be pushed back further. But that is at the moment what they're aiming for, is that... they'll land someone on the moon again, they'll land someone on an asteroid, and then when they're done with that, they'll land some people on Mars. But NASA, crucially, wants to get people back. They don't want to do it unless they can get people back again. Whereas people like organizations like Mars One, they're in it really... They want to be first. Like, that's the key thing. They're interested in... Well, Elon Musk wants to colonize, but I think Mars One is really just like, we want to see that we can do it, because once you get there, you're not getting back again at current technology.
I know, which I think space exploration is really wonderful, and it kind of one of those things that makes you feel slightly weepy about the, you know, the majesty of the human spirit. But equally, well, unless there's sort of a point to it just feels a bit like, I feel like, how about people climbing Everest now, right? You know, the way that's become incredibly commercialized, and it's just so that you can say that you've done it. Mm. What's the point in that? I don't know. I'm not going to ask you to explain to me why.
Yeah, I feel if they do go to Mars, people might eventually lose interest because it's been done.
Mm.
Like the Apollo mission, when they were on the moon, everyone's all excited. But after a while, people are like, oh, you know,
moon schmoon.
Moon schmoon. And I feel like if they ever, you know, inhabit Mars, it would just be a thing of the past, and people will, you know, as humans, we want to, you know, look out and find new things that, you know, fascinate us. We might, you know, decide that Mars isn't really a target anymore. You might want to go to, you know, Pluto, for example.
Which isn't a real planet anymore.
Yeah.
Sad that. I wonder also if it's a part of the fact that there's been an increasing realisation that the rest of space outside the solar system is so unbelievably unattainable that, you know, I know this is a really banal statement, but the universe is really, really big and the distances involved are really, really large. And just in terms of a human lifespan, at the moment, there is no conceivable way of us getting
anywhere. But at the same time, there is the threat that we will, you know, kill ourselves as a species through some extinction event, or something else will come along, like an asteroid that we can't stop or don't see until it's too late. So there is the school of thought that colonizing Mars at other places like the moon and some of the moons of Jupiter, for instance, it's an insurance policy. It's a way for us to make sure that if something does happen back on Earth, there's a large enough breeding population, you know, living in caves on Mars or wherever. Or in the clouds of Venus or in space stations somewhere, that they can kind of come back after a few years when the nuclear dust is settled.
That's a cheery thought. One of the things I think is really interesting when you talk to astronauts, she says swankily, having talked to a grand total of 3 astronauts, I think probably for a piece I wrote a while ago, is that you begin to realise the sheer difficulty of doing anything in space. So it starts off with the fact that, you know, the way that gravity acts on our skeletons, for example, they have a huge problem with loss of bone density. And you can wear a kind of harness, really, that sort of shoves you down onto a treadmill. But Chris Hadfield says you never get that pelvic girdle, that you can't, there's no no way apart from load bearing to exercise that. So it takes you, you know, you have all these great pictures of astronauts landing when they come back down in the capsule, and they will do the thumbs up. And that's because that's like the only thing that they can do at that point, because it must feel like a huge crushing weight.
And the rescue teams that go and meet them in the, like the forest of Siberia or wherever, they will carry them, like, and it looks like, oh, they're just astronauts. They're awesome. Today. Hooray! No, they can't walk. That's why they're being carried.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about what's Mars like for if you want to go there on your holidays.
Well, gravity's not as strong for a start, so all those issues. We don't know what would happen to humans who lived, died, bred, and had children and generations of children on Mars. Like, would they end up really tall? Or would they end up taller but weaker or whatever? We don't really know what's going to happen there.
If you were born on Mars, presumably you could probably never come home. I mean, not that it would be home for
probably
you.
Unless you were extremely physically fit, because the change in gravity would be pretty intense.
About 60% less. So if you weigh 100 kilograms here, you weigh about 38 there.
Yeah.
So yeah,
this would be a great way to technically lose weight, because either you wouldn't lose weight, you'd lose mass. But no, hang on a minute,
you'd have to.
I would get on the scales, and it would say less, and that was the important thing.
My guess would be that you'd lose bone density and also muscle density, because you don't need as strong muscles to do stuff. I mean, you'd have to like really try to build up resistance.
Funnily enough, the temperature is not such an issue. It's about -60 on.
Kind of like living in Antarctica. We can handle that.
It really fluctuates. I think up in, you know, the poles, it can, you know, drop as low as 183 degrees, whereas in the summer in the equator, it's about 20 degrees. So I think the huge, you know, drastic difference in temperature obviously isn't very good for humans. We're very fragile and, you know, delicate creatures. I don't think we could handle such, you know, transitions in temperature.
The radiation's not good either, is it?
Yeah, and that also causes a lot of humidity at night as well, which isn't good.
That makes it very hard to sleep.
Yeah.
I imagine you can't really leave the window open either. That's the other problem. And it has terrific dust storms as well.
It does. These, it lasts for days.
With these big particle dust devils, or that they call them.
Yeah, it really is. Trying to live on Mars is... well, we've all seen Total Recall. It's going to be worse than that, really. The original, not the remake. That's terrible film.
And I think one of the things that actually you could do, which just isn't very exciting if you want to do something like this, is you could do some of the things that the Russians have been doing, for example, about just putting people in a can and making them live there for a really long time and not, you know, letting them have anything from the outside. And ditto people living on Antarctica. Because one of the things I think that's really underexplored is that you could solve all the technical problems. And I'm sure, you know, given the rate of human progress, we will. Can you ever solve the psychological problems of what it's like to lock people up in a tiny space together? Because there was a big fight.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
In one of the simulators, and people end up sort of like having to put locks on their doors, and it's not, you know, if you get locked in a tin can with somebody, I mean, again, talking about films, we've all seen like Sunshine. If somebody looks into the sun
too long, it doesn't go well. I imagine there's a lot to be learned here from looking at the narratives that came out of early colonial settlers in places like Australia or the Americas, who often went off knowing they would never return home, and they were going to a place that had very few people on it, and it was at the time a very inhospitable environment. The technology at the time, we didn't have refrigeration, for instance. You know, there are some serious technological issues to overcome at that period.
What we really need in that situation is to have people who already live on Mars, like native Marsians, who have actually, because that's one of the things that colonial settlers never did, was they never actually took the time to speak to people who'd been living in that, for example, the Aboriginal Australians. But yeah, we can't really, unfortunately, unless we find Martians and they're not microbes.
Hey, fingers crossed, we might still do. Let's hope we don't step on any. We arrive, lower the drawbridge and squeeze it.
Tosin, would you go into space?
Oh, no.
And never come back?
My feet are firmly placed on planet Earth, thank you very much.
I'd love to go to space. I'd probably chicken out at the last minute and run away while it was in the spacesuit or whatever in a kind of hilarious...
You have to be in the space suit for like 12 hours on launch day. I'm just putting this out that this is already a problem, that you have to wear a nappy on launch day.
I'd get an itch and I'd feel like it's like just cancel launch, I have to itch it. I'd volunteer if it was like, hey, do you want to live on the moon for 9 months in a kind of Antarctica type research / mining operation? Go like, yeah, that could be an experience, but not Mars.
Okay.
Not Mars.
Well, I would love to hear from anybody who would take that one-way journey, because I think to me it's something that's, yeah, I get panicked on the northern, on the northern line. But for the moment, I'll say thank you very much to Tosin and Ian. It's a meta podcast now, as we are going to talk to you a little bit about what podcasts we like. Caroline Crampton joins me along with Barbara Speed because they like podcasts. I'm going to start with the elephant in the room, the absolute beer moth, which is cereal. Pro or anti-cereal?
I was pro. I enjoyed listening to it. It was a great story. It was, if for people who don't know, although if you're listening to a podcast, you probably do, This American Life, a public radio station program in America, produced their first spin-off show, which was a single investigation into a sort of cold case crime in Baltimore. And they did it over 12 episodes, I think. And it was a massive hit. Lots and millions of people downloaded it. And it what I didn't like was what happened afterwards, which was the conversation, particularly on American news websites, about how, woo, podcasting is a thing now. Serial has brought back podcasts. Podcasts did not go anywhere. Certain journalists had just forgotten they existed.
I've had a kind of pro-podcast bias, I guess, because there was a phase about 2 years ago when everybody was instructed that video was the future. And this was a kind of thing that was entirely driven by advertising. So you can sell pre-roll videos of 30 seconds for incredibly high rates, really, compared with display advertising, on the belief that, as is this always sort of naive and optimistic belief, that people will watch anything because it's sort of like the internet in it. And the problem was, I felt that a lot of people didn't have the resources to put into videos. And it's a bit shady, really, just to put your own advert in front of something you've nicked off YouTube. So there was this sort of outcrop, really, of people doing terrible, terrible video that involved someone sort of either sort of sitting at their desk boringly explaining something to you, or some people in a kind of shed doing something with ping pong balls. And whereas actually, when you've got a small budget as a news organisation, video isn't, you know, you have to compete with Sky News, you have to put a lot of money. That stuff costs a lot of money. And it's quite difficult to do any kind of video recorded stuff. Whereas, you know, radio recording and podcast recording, you've got some decent mics, you've got a decent amplifier, you know, you've got a basic garage band on a Mac. You can produce something that sounds relatively interesting. So to me, it was always, podcasts were always a better thing to do alongside, rather than, you know, if you couldn't set up a specialist video division. Mm. And is this cruel and wrong, Barbara? Are you one of these young people that watches all the videos on Vice?
No, I don't actually like watching videos online. I don't know why. But I think podcasting is good and it is a lot cheaper. However, I'd say that the sort of advances in podcasting are towards much higher budget, much fancy. I mean, even Serial, they had like, what, 4 people working full time on that for over a year?
Yeah.
And it was only 12 episodes long. And again, I mean, the kind of the big podcasts in America, quite high budget there. They pull in like news teams from local radio stations around the country. They have a huge resource with that. But I think you're right. I think you can do something successful on a much lower budget, and it's not cringy and it doesn't have bad lighting.
But there's definitely something in that the what is really reassuring is where the money goes in podcasting is on the expertise and the journalism and the editing and the hard work on the content, basically. It doesn't go on the cameras and lights and the sort of window dressing of it.
Well, that's one of the things that I feel a lot about Serial is an example of, or This American Life, is that the collaging technique that they used to put together to tell the stories is actually incredibly labour-intensive. And sort of Serial is kind of like, and then we found the person that had been working at the store in 1999, and you think, like, just that one sentence has, you know, days and days of boring, old-fashioned journalism looking through phone books and
court records
because it was American, they video and record a lot of their court sessions and police interviews and then make them available to the public. Someone had watched hours, days of footage in order to find 15 seconds of the perfect summation of the case from the prosecution.
But it wore that very lightly. And I think one of the things, so This American Life is kind of the granddaddy of these things, I suppose, which spawned Serial. It is a bit, sometimes a little bit do-goodery and smug. I think we're probably going to have to say that.
Yeah, absolutely. But also, the thing that frustrates me about it a bit is that it hasn't changed in 10 years. the internet's changed, the world has changed, this American life has not changed.
But what it does that I like is that it jams together things that seem quite different into a theme. So there was a recent episode where they had Lindy West, who used to work for Jezebel, talking about confronting a guy who had trolled her online by pretending to be her father, who had recently died of lung cancer. But also on that same episode, it had the story of how, I think it was ospreys in the national park, and there was a camera that was on the osprey nest, and the mother osprey turned out to be really bad at parenting and was like bullying one of the chicks and not feeding. But the trouble was that people got really outraged about this and were like wanting to basically sort of like call social services on the osprey, but that doesn't exist because nature is really cruel and sometimes ospreys are not good mothers. But it linked together because it was exactly the same thing that they started then hounding the park ranger, saying, you know, intervene in the osprey situation. And actually, that I like that model of here is a theme and we're going to knock it about and look at it from several different ways, which again is, I guess, because podcasts are more sprawling. Not our podcast, obviously, which is incredibly tightly edited and every word is a gem. But you know what I mean? It's certainly, for me, I enjoy doing radio far more than TV because you can say sometimes more than three sentences at a time. Mm. But tell me about these fictional podcasts, not that you listen to.
Well, so what you were just saying, the brilliant thing about podcasts is that anyone can start one with a very small amount of tech. And so therefore you've got, there are podcasts available on pretty much any subject that you can think of, including creative writing and fiction. I suppose probably the most well-known example is called Welcome to Night Vale, which is a, it's again an American production. We should come on to why so many of these big ones are American in a second. But Night Vale, it takes the form of broadcast from a community radio station in a fictional town called Night Vale. And so it's all read from the point of view of the newsreader who's doing local notices, telling you about what happened at the Parent Teacher Association, telling you about planning things. Apart from this town seems to be, I don't know, on a rift in the space-time continuum or something, because terrible dystopian things keep happening there. But it's all told in this incredibly mundane, like, BBC local radio almost type way. And there are recurring characters and things that happen multiple times and different effects they do with sound. And it's just really compelling. And that kind of storytelling, I think, you can only do that with a podcast. I can't really see how that would work anywhere else.
Well, let's talk about the British thing, because, I mean, when I thought about what my favourite podcasts are, actually what I'm really, when I talk about podcasts that I like, I'm really talking about Radio 4 factual programmes that are available as a download. Mm. So I'm a big fan of Great Lives, which is hosted by Matthew Paris and kind of gets somebody relatively great and good to nominate a random historical figure that they really like. So they'll do kind of like Lucretia Borgia. And then, you know, next week it'll be Jacqueline Dupre. And then there's all the politics output, like Week in Westminster, and things like that gets converted to podcasts. And then I know you're a big fan of things like Cabin Pressure and stuff like that, which are all available. Have we got the same problem that news websites have often complained about, which is that having the BBC as a huge free provider distorts the market and actually means that there's no appetite for independent producers?
I don't think there's no appetite, but I do think it's harder to get recognised, because not only is the BBC producing a load of great stuff, they were also in on podcasts really early. They were early adopters. And so I think for a lot of British people, like you say, when they think of podcasts, they do think of, well, then I go to the BBC. If you in the top 10 on iTunes, often like three or four of them will be different BBC ones. They really do dominate. But part of the problem, if you do want to do an independent podcast in Britain, is that there isn't the money, there isn't the sort of the advertising, the funding and the sponsors, because there hasn't been that market. So the people who are doing independent podcasts in Britain, there's a great one called Answer Me This, new one called The Illusionist by Helen Zaltzman, who I've interviewed in this week's magazine, have launched. Their money is coming from America. They are joining up with American podcasters and attracting the same sponsors as they are. So they're kind of working off the American scene, even though they are based in Britain. I don't know what you think, Barbara.
I think that sounds about right, really.
Do you have any British podcast that you listen to? Because I think one that springs to mind is The Bugle, which is John Oliver and Andy Zaltzman's one, and it's quite sporty.
And that was the Times initially funded that, I think back in sort of 2006-07, when news organisations were kind of dipping their toe into the water of podcasts. And then they went independent after they said some stuff about phone hacking that turned out to not be very popular with their funders. And they did, I suppose it's crowdfunding, although they didn't go through anything like Kickstarter. They just said, hey, listeners, we've sort of been sacked. If you want us to keep doing this, you're going to have to chuck us some money. And people overwhelmingly did, and they're still going 5 years later.
But I think that's the interesting point, is that so much of the crowdfunding thing, it seems incredibly democratic on the surface, but what you often get is people leveraging existing platforms. So it becomes easy for Zach Braff to fund something when people have already seen him in mainstream Hollywood movies, or it's easier for the people behind the Bugle. I mean, I wouldn't say it's easy, but it's easier.
They're both stand-up comedians. They have existing audiences. John Oliver used to be on The Daily Show. You know, they've got an audience. But the problem... Well, not a problem, but it's interesting that there are very few full-time podcasters in Britain. In America, there are. People like Dan Savage and Roman Mars are podcasters. That is what they are known for. But here, people are comedians first who also do a podcast, or journalists first who also do a podcast, or whatever.
And even the content itself can go from being one thing to being another. I mean, just like radio shows ending up as podcasts, or, I mean, The Guardian long reads now are released as podcasts. And they're quite good, but they don't do anything with it beyond just reading out the long
feature. Well, The Economist do this crazy thing where they hire actors to read out the whole of The Economist, and like, unfortunately not in like, and lo, did Yanis Varoufakis come to the Eurozone. But that's the thing, is that I would love to know what is the best way of encouraging more creativity in podcasts. Because like you say, that when you're talking about, that sounds to me like that's somebody who's found a kind of a comic conceit and a kind of dramatic conceit that is best expressed through the podcast form. And therefore there is more potential there. But have we got a way for that to happen, to encourage the next one of that to happen?
I think there's also a kind of, there's a bit of a myth around podcasting and also, to a lesser extent, blogging, that it's something quick and instantaneous, that you just whack it up and then you become internet famous sort of thing. Whereas actually, you have to work very hard at it and do it consistently for a long time in order to build up the kind of audience that will then fund you or whatever you need them to do. That it's hard graft and not necessarily all that fun, like life.
I thought you were going to say, unlike this podcast, which is super awesome fun always to make.
But this idea that you can just like open your MacBook, talk into the speaker, and then become
a podcaster. Yeah, but in vlogging you can do that. Like, I sometimes try and watch these kind of massive YouTube stars, and I think, it's all right, but, a bit of editing wouldn't go amiss.
But they do a lot of it, and they do it over a long time, and they build up a story and all that sort of stuff. It's not like a one-off.
When they get really big is when they start having guests who are famous, either from that community or not, and they do editing, which might... I think there's a kind of a trend for stuff looking amateurish because it emphasises you're this normal person. But actually, they are editing it to be like that. They have, like, bloopers at the end of their, like, showreel and stuff, and it's kind of like... That might be the effect, but I think the really successful ones sit all day thinking of creative ways to
do a video
blog.
In a way, I think it's a thing that I'm surprised about, is that people have... Because one of the things that joys for me is podcasts, is it's something I can listen to when I'm walking to work, for example, right? Whereas a video demands your full attention and you can't do anything else at the same time. So maybe this is a story about how young people have actually got excellently long attention spans because they can do that, whereas us people in our later 20s and 30s, we don't... chuck with that. We need to kind of have something else going on. We need to be twin screening and listening to a podcast as well. Well, I'm sure none of our listeners, I'm sure, were doing anything other than listening to every pearl that we've been offering them. Please do tweet us if you have any suggestions for podcasts. Just tweet at New Statesman. But for the moment, I'll say thank you very much to both Caroline and Barbara. You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast, presented by me, Helen Lewis, and produced by Anna Leskovitz. You can find us every week at newstatesman.com/podcast or on iTunes. Our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.